in a word, the biggest change I think I've seen. The hospital has grown enormously, so that in the 60s and 70s it moved into bigger emphasis on new specialties, so that I don't know the number of senior staff members, mainly based here in Cooperstown, but I would guess that it's 75 to 100 physicians now, which for a town of 2,500 is ridiculous. But of course the tentacles of the hospital extend in several directions, 50 to more miles. And it was a time when I was quite busy, worked 6 days a week in the office, and took house calls, and often had Sunday duties of one sort or another, particularly if I was an attending on a ward. And all of this is quite different now, because doctors consider their off time far more precious than was the case 50 years ago when I started.
Did you have an office in the hospital?
Yes.
Okay. So you were also on the planning board in Cooperstown for a number of years.
Not truly on the planning board as such. I was on the Zoning Board of Appeals, okay, which had the responsibility of making certain decisions as to whether things would be permitted, but planning in the sense of looking ahead and making long-term. And then I served on several ad hoc committees that did have planning jobs, but this came about after I'd been here almost 10 years and had asked some questions about local government and so forth, and got interested and was, I guess I had started in 66, so that was 7 years after we got here. I joined the Board of Trustees.
Board of Trustees where? I'm sorry.
For the village of Cooperstown.
Okay. And what were your experiences like on the board, on the zoning board?
Well, there was a Mr. Ken Shepherd was the first mayor that I served under, and then Stuart Tahar was the second. And I would not have been elected mayor had one of the more senior persons on the board not up and died. So when he did, I was sort of pushed ahead to be mayor after I'd been a trustee for 4 years. As a trustee, you were supposed to pay attention to the village committees, and I was on the village hall. I was on parks committee. I had something to do, I think, with the water and sewer. But the board would meet once a month, and we would sometimes be given jobs to do. And mostly we were just a rubber stamp for what was recommended either by the head of the village streets or by the head of the water board or the police, single policeman. And we didn't have a lot of crime or, as far as I could tell, a great deal of interest by the citizenry in what was going on. I think when I was elected a trustee, it was at the time when the Democratic and Republican parties each supported the same nominee. So there would be a Democrat and a Republican suggested by the caucus, and both got elected, and probably not by more than 60 or 80 votes out of however many voters there were. perhaps 1,000 or more. So pretty paltry village interest in the board. But I will say that we had bought a house over on Leatherstocking Street, and I saw what my taxes were, and the fellow next door had a bigger house and a bigger yard, and I saw that his taxes were half of what mine were. So I went down to talk to the fellow who was the village clerk at the time, Mr. Gilmore, a colorful lad, who said, sure, I can give you an idea. We haven't been appraised for a long time. We're talking about having our properties appraised. And I said, well, I don't know much about the village budget. Have you got a budget? And with a great hearty laugh, he says, my son, nobody in the 25 years that I've been a village clerk has ever asked me for the budget. I present you one with great aplomb. And it was not long after that that a couple of the village trustees then on the board came by my house and said, Mr. Gilmore says you're interested in local government. Would you consider running for trustee? By the way, what party do you belong to? And I said, well, I suppose I'm about 51% Republican. This was in Eisenhower times. And I don't think since then I've voted for a single national Republican. Nevertheless, they said, well, 51% is enough for us. We'll support you. And that was the my introduction into local politics. And 4 years later, I was mayor for 2 years. And then after that, I was on the village board of, that is the zoning control board for another 25 or 30 years. And it's only been about 10 years that I've moved away from that sort of village and responsibility.
Now, you were only mayor for 2 years?
That was common back in those days. Okay. Actually, the mayor who preceded me had been elected to the county board, and he couldn't serve in both those positions, so I actually was mayor for about 2 years and 3 months, because on the 1st of January he had to give up his mayorship, and so I was moved in, and it was a March election, so I had 2 extra months out of those 2 years, 2 months, so to speak.
Did you enjoy being mayor?
Yes. It was busy. I was still practicing. Had a busy clinical practice. I had to get on my bicycle at 11 o'clock most mornings, scoot to the office, see what the problems were. We were at the time cited by the state for running an open dump, and I had to arrange a new dump. We were having trouble that the longtime village policeman had gotten too old to do the job, so we were hiring new policemen, and they were of a different sort from the old fellow. Not that they weren't suitable, they were just different. And we had, instead of one policeman who was on duty when he felt like it, to three who had a regular thing, and they wanted certain union recommended privileges, which were hard to arrange. We were also in the process of building these houses across the street, Fernley Over, which the hospital very much needed, but there wasn't a regulation that would permit such a thing. So we had to arrange for a consultant to come by, and we added to the zoning laws something like coordinated development district and so forth. And so there were these issues that quickly come to my mind that kept me busy, as well as trying to keep a view of what was going on in the village. And at the time, this was Vietnam, and maybe you don't remember that there was a very unhappy thing that happened at Kent State. Ever heard about that? And some young people said, could we fly the flag at half-mast? Which I thought was a simple request. Didn't think twice about it. So I told the policeman to let it fly at half-mast. In the middle of the night, I would receive a phone call. You yellow-bellied communist, don't you know that these upstart hippie kids weren't worth a damn, and look at the people dying over in Vietnam and so forth? So that occasionally there were issues that were worldwide that would impinge on the mail, but basically it was just taking care of business here at home.
Did you have, or did you know people who served in Vietnam? Did any of your children serve? Or
no, no? None of my family served there, but there were people from here in town. I knew the parents of the one boy that died there from Cooperstown. I knew the parents from a boy from Hartwick who died there. And then there were a lot of kids who are now 60 and 65 years old who were serving over there. And I know them personally and speak to them every time I see them. So that Vietnam era is still pretty fresh in my mind.
Were you a part of the hospital development? You mentioned that it grew from like a rather small hospital when you first came to Cooperstown to now being like 75 doctors.
Yeah. Was I a part of it in the sense of suggesting it or taking a leadership role? No.
Or even watching the development of it? What have you
noticed? Well, you couldn't help but watch it because there were new doctors coming, and you'd meet them and give them a plus or a minus rating of sorts. After a while, they were coming with such regularity that they'd be here for a year almost before I'd even get to meet them.
Wow. So is this area then where we are mostly housing for people at Bassett?
Over there, yes, entirely for Bassett. And maybe two or three apartments in which they can have visiting speakers stay for two or three days, something like that.
Did your practice and approach to medicine, was it influenced by the influx of doctors coming in?
It was slightly influenced, yes. There were, when we were just a group of six or seven in internal medicine, one being more interested in neurology and one a little bit more interested in endocrine diseases, and the others, I was fairly broadly spread. When a new cardiologist came in, we would call him in for very complicated situations, but most of us had a good deal of training in cardiac diseases so that we didn't quickly refer. If somebody came in with a sore shoulder, I didn't call the orthopedic surgeon right away. I tried to find out the aspects of mobility and strength and just exactly how long the process had been going on, and was perfectly willing to say, it doesn't look too serious. Let's see you again in a week, or call me up if it's not better. Just don't go throwing a football around for 3 days or something like that. which was sort of the, one could say, a laid-back approach to this. I had the feeling from all along that Mother Nature was pretty generally kindly toward us, and that the more you got into quick measures to either use medications or start getting all sorts of x-rays and so forth was probably not something that was necessary. And nowadays, with the legal situation, what it is, if you come in with a sore shoulder and don't get an MRI of the shoulder, you're likely to get sued because one out of 100 of them has a strange situation that ought to be recognized early. But 99 out of 100 are going to get not much worse or maybe even a lot better in a very short period of time. So that that's another change in medicine which is enormously different, this threat of being sued if you don't use every test known to man, almost, for the simplest of things. And when I was ready to retire, I proposed the possibility of staying on in a less fancy capacity to be a sort of an ever-ready clinic, so that if you called up at midnight with a sore throat, someone would say, "Is it? Can you breathe all right? Can you swallow? And are you feeling that this is the sickest you've ever been, or is it just pretty uncomfortable?" And if it were not serious by any of those questions, they would say, "Well, Dr. Herman could see you tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, and he will check you over. But if you want to come to the emergency room, you can. It's $75 to come in. You'll get a chest x-ray. You might get an electrocardiogram. You'll get a whole bunch of blood studies. And 9 times out of 10, you didn't need that." So I was aware that this change in medicine was occurring, and was hoping that the hospital would agree to having a dispensary of some sort in which I might work, and maybe with the help of a physician's assistant or something like that. But that was not the way the hospital chose to go. And so I more or less have been retired since 64, although I did help out a little bit in some outlying clinics when doctors were on vacation or something like that. But certainly since 66 or 67, I haven't done any medical practice.
Wow.
Not 66, 96 and 97.
Was that a need that you saw in the community around Cooperstown?
Oh, yeah. I had patients who came in to see me. Well, I was in the emergency clinic last week. Why should I have paid $450 for a sore throat? And I saw that happen more than once, and I went to the powers and said, this doesn't seem to me to be the way we ought to be going.
Well, what have you done since you've retired?
Well, I've been involved in quite a lot of volunteer activities that I can point to. I'm busy here at home in the backyard with all sorts of jobs that are required there. But I joined Habitat for Humanity pretty early on and met new friends, and I worked 2 full days a week in building. And I was the treasurer for a while, and I've been on a number of committees that are necessary: volunteer, site selection, construction committee, families, so forth. And that's been a very satisfying thing. Then for about 6 or 7 years, I was with the Catskill Symphony Orchestra, and I was treasurer for a while when they were on the skids, and we were trying to find out exactly how much money was owed here, there, and yonder, and keep a budget going and so forth. And I enjoyed meeting new friends there. That got me into the Oneonta circuit, and I made quite a number of nice connections and friends that I like there. And I continued to work for the village in the business of the Zoning Board of Appeals. And there must have been a few other things I did here and there, but those come to mind now.
Well, what drew you to Habitat for Humanity in particular?
Well, I had a patient who was busy in it, and he first said, you're going to be retiring in a year or two. Would you think of joining Habitat? And I said, well, tell me what you do. And he said, well, we try to build simple, decent homes for people who can afford to pay us back for the materials but don't pay for the labor. And I read about Habitat and began to hear what it was doing. And once I got into it and met friends and saw how dedicated some of the people who are in it are, that had an appeal for me. I mean, I was not going to continue practicing medicine on the side or as a private practitioner or doing anything like that. That didn't seem right. I had close to 40 years of medical practice, so I had enjoyed construction work too, so that was the stimulus to get interested in it. And once I got involved, and sort of fun not to have lunch with doctors who were complaining about insurance people or the government or other doctors or even patients, and to be talking about just other things. And so it's been a good thing for me.
Good. What has been one of your highlights of participating in Habitat?
Well, there have been some highlights and some low spots. The highlights are seeing somebody who energetically and enthusiastically and devotedly joins as a partner family, puts in their sweat equity hours, keeps you informed of how they are doing. You get to know their families, and you see them move from somebody who was living in a very unsatisfactory and unhygienic spot to living in a nice home, and then afterwards being willing to work on other people's homes. And I can name several of our families who've been that way, and that's what boosts your spirits. And then there have been some that we've built for who've not kept up the homes, who've not paid their necessary return to us, and have had to be evicted. And they've kept the place in us. They've been poor neighbors where they were, poor citizens. Just while I don't want to think of myself as elitist, these are the trashiest people I've dealt with. Not too many of them, but some. And then there's some who simply pay their rent, or pay their mortgage return and so forth, do not help with other people's families, don't happen to seem to have much gratitude for what I think must have been a big step up in their living conditions. And we're trying to figure out how can we, as Habitat, be more selective in certain ways, but also more understanding of the pressures that people have to with their other obligations in life. I mean, it would be nice to think that they really think we're wonderful people who are helping them and have given them a great step up in life and so forth and been great to their children. And yes, we're thankful and we're grateful and we'll help out again. And that just doesn't happen often. When it does, it's a wonderful thing. When it doesn't, you try to move on to find somebody that you will be able to say that about.
How are families chosen to participate?
A family has to apply. We advertise what we do and we have some publicity, but they must, one, be living in some way in a substandard house, either too crowded, too cold, too expensive to keep up, leaks when it rains, etc. So they have to be living in substandard housing, they have to be willing to put in their sweat equity hours, and they have to have some form of income that allows them to repay us for what our outright expenses are. Beyond that, we would like to think that they're not very far in debt, because if they are $50,000 in debt for TVs and automobiles and junk like that, we're dubious that they're going to be able to pay us back. We'd like to think that they are not sexual perverts. We're supposed to ask that question. We would like to think that they have a true desire to make an improvement in their own lives for their sake and for their children's sake. And beyond that, there's no religious requirement or marital requirement, anything like that. We bill for single parents. We bill for people who don't have, never did have husbands or so forth. So that we're not looking to have just a special group of believers of any sort, because you don't have to be a believer. And although it was a Christian organization to start with and has those tenets, lots of us are not very devout Christians.
So you went back to LaGrange with Habitat for Humanity?
I did, but I think it was 6 years ago. I had a wonderful time. Jimmy Carter was building there for a week along with two other places down in the South. And two of my friends from this affiliate went down. We stayed for a week. We had a great time. Built about 20, 25 houses in a week. Of 500 people from LaGrange and around, and 500 people from the rest of the country. It was an anthill.
So could you talk a little bit about how you met Nancy?
Yeah. You were jumping around.
We are jumping around. Yeah. Sorry.
Nancy came to Cooperstown in 1970 with her husband. And turned out that she and my wife became friends. There was a 10-year gap there, but Nancy was a young mother with a 6-year-old and younger, and my wife's oldest at the time would have been 14 or 15.